Maybe you've stumbled in front of the family pet or dropped something or just did something you're glad no person was around to see. Then you look at the dog or cat, probably a cat, and notice it looking squarely at you. Did the family pet just judge you? We can't know, can we? But we can put a lot of effort into understanding what and how animals think, seldom pausing to think about our own intelligence and its components. Our guest this hour does think about human thinking, too. His new book is Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Franz Duval lives in Atlanta and works two jobs. He's a professor in Emory University's psychology department and the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. His earlier books include The Bonobo and the Atheist. Franz Duval has been listed as one of the 100 most influential people by Time magazine. Franz Duval, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
I'm glad to be there.
We've been down this road before with Carl Safina and Virginia Morell, both of whom provided blurbs for your book. How profound is our thinking about animal thinking in recent years?
Well, I think it has changed. So in the previous century, let's say, we downplayed animal intelligence, and we had ways of testing them in little boxes called Skinner boxes. There was all they could press a lever and get rewards for it, and that's all very smart and so on. But we didn't challenge them to the full extent, and we also didn't look at them as different. So animals have their own environment, and let's say a dolphin is a very different animal than an elephant, just by virtue of the fact that they have a very different survival strategy. And we didn't take that into account. And I think most of that has now changed, and the study of animal intelligence has really taken off as a result.
I should point out that there are illustrations in the book, plenty of them, including some cartoons, and including one that shows a bunch of scientists with the Skinner boxes you just mentioned, and their mazes, because this seems to be the real stampede that happened for years in the business.
Yeah, that is an old cartoon from the 1950s, and that shows already that at that time already there was resistance to the simplification of animals. And this cartoon came from an article by Frank Beach, who said that we should stop testing just pigeons and rats, and we should start looking at other species. He worked with dogs, and actually there's a lot of interest now in dogs, and there's dog labs that test dogs on intelligence.
There is an answer to the book's title, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And you provide it on page 3. What is the answer?
The answer is, I think we are smart enough. It takes a lot of imagination and creativity to test animals the right way. We have not shown, so basically the answer is, we have not shown that we are smart enough, but I hope, I'm an optimist, I hope that we are smart enough to do that.
So it's not the animals you're waiting on, it's the humans.
Yeah, it is a challenge because we work with all sorts of animals. There's all sorts of studies, for example, on crows now. Now, a crow is, again, a very different animal from us. And so how do we connect with the intelligence of crows? That's all very challenging.
I'm glad you brought up crows because there's a fun story in the book of you and jackdaws in college. How did that relationship start?
Oh, I've always loved jackdaws, which are small crows that live in Europe. And they were also the favorite animal of Konrad Lorenz, one of the pioneers of etology. And as a student even, I got involved in a project on jackdaws, which usually nest in church towers and in chimneys and things like that, so in houses. And you can find them there, and you can ring the young, and then you can do certain studies on them. So I've always had jackdaws and always loved working with them. Most of the time they flew away because I usually wouldn't lock them up. And so in the fall, when all the crows gather to start traveling to the south, the jackdaws would be drawn into that and they would leave.
There were some observations about the jackdaws learning to fly and you feeling like you were along with them. I mean, obviously...
Yeah, so I use that story to tell you that you can enter the umwelt of an animal. The umwelt is their world of perception, the world in which they live and which they perceive things. And, of course, it is very challenging to do that with animals that are totally different from us. Let's say the bat, who has echolocation, it's very hard to understand the umwelt of a bat. But with a bird, these jackdaws, which were learning to fly, which is already interesting, it shows that flight, you think of flying for a bird as an instinctive behavior, but they have to learn to fly and they have to learn to land especially, which is very tricky. And when they're young, they have a lot of trouble with that. And so I would be watching them from my window up a big dormitory, and would be following them. And as soon as they landed, they would be very happy and give me calls, and I would call them back to fly back to me. And so as a sort of parent, I would be overseeing their flight lessons. But of course, it's a sort of behavior that I cannot really relate to, but I would get into it anyway.
The happy calls are really interesting, because I said a couple of months ago on the air that I'd seen some crows flying into some wind here, and I thought they sounded like they were saying, yeehaw, because they were having fun. I mean, does that sort of thing really happen?
Well, crows and ravens are known to play in the wind, you know, because they're such good flyers. They're so flexible. Ravens can even fly upside down, ridiculously enough. They do that sometimes. And it seems very playful when they do that. It seems like they don't need to do that, but they think it's fun to turn upside down in the middle of the air.
Wow, okay. Let's come back to the general sense of how things have gone in our thinking about animals. It's not been a straight line. I mean, it sounds like there were times where we did think about animal thoughts, and then we kind of let that lay. Science changed, and then we came back to it again?
Yeah, there were several pioneers that were sort of ignored and poo-pooed. So the first one was Wolfgang Köhler, was a German scientist who did intelligence tests on chimpanzees, and instead of dictating their behavior like what the behaviorists were doing, he would set up an open-ended situation. He would hang a banana very high, and he would give his chimps a bunch of boxes and a bunch of sticks, and he would see what they would do. And the chimps he described, they would try to get there and jump and do all sorts of things, but they would be unsuccessful. And then at some point they would stack up the boxes and reach for the banana. So the stacking up part he called insight. He said they had, by thinking, they had arrived at the solution to this particular problem.
Okay, we'll pick it up on the other side of a break. We're talking to Franz Duval about his book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Franz Duval and your comments in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Franz Duval, who works with animals in psychology and in primatology. His book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? It's a provocative question for whether we're in a good position to judge what other creatures are thinking and how they think on the face of the earth. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. You might have some stories to tell or questions to ask. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So we're talking about the work of Wolfgang Köhler, and this is interesting stuff. So in a room where he hung the banana too high, the apes did finally figure out to stack boxes to be able to reach the banana.
Yeah, so the important part of the experiment was that the apes had never been rewarded for the solution. And so he demonstrated that they can arrive at the solution by just sitting around and staring at the problem, and at some point they think up the solution. And so people were very upset at the time that he claimed that animals could think and could reason. And it's still today that there are many scientists who don't want to pronounce the name Köhler because they hiss his name. They hate him so much because he was the first one to say, well, with instinct and learning, simple associative learning, you don't get there. There's more going on in the head of an animal. And nowadays, of course, we strongly believe that because there's all sorts of other evidence, not just from the chimpanzees. And actually, my book is very much on explaining how our view of many other species has changed, because everyone knows that chimps are smart and that dolphins are smart. But once we describe certain capacities in the apes, let's say, very soon, usually within 10 years, there's people doing the same thing on dogs, on dolphins, on elephants, on crows. And so we actually, our entire view of the animal kingdom is changing, is that yes, chimps are smart and humans are smart, but there's many other animals who are very intelligent.
Well, most of your work is with primates, and I wonder if we give them more credit than other animals for being smart because they are more like us.
Yeah, that's one of the problems, and that's why I'm asking this question, are we smart enough to know how smart other animals are? Because for chimps, we can relate so easily. They have two hands, they have frontal eyes, their body is basically the same as our body. So for chimps, it's very easy for us to understand their intelligence. But now you go to a bat, let's say. A bat flies around in the dark and catches prey with echolocation. Now, we humans, we don't usually look at that as a sign of high cognition, because we don't do it and we cannot relate to it. But actually, the bat has a big area of its brain is devoted to processing the information in order to do this, because they need to emit sounds and pick up the echoes and calculate their own trajectory when they fly and calculate their prey trajectory. And so they have a lot of calculation to do in their brain. And anyone who has radar in an airplane knows that it's not a simple task. So it is cognition and it is complex, but since we don't do anything like it, we don't really pay that much attention. We don't consider it part of intelligence and cognition.
And as you point out as well, they have to be careful not to bump into other bats. So there's a lot going on.
Yeah, with the bats, it's even remarkable if they live in a cave with a million others, let's say, and they fly out at night, they have to recognize their own sounds. And so I'm very interested in this self-recognition part. Because we do tests on, let's say, apes and chimpanzees and elephants on the mirror test to see if they can recognize their own reflection. But actually, the bat, when they fly out with a lot of other bats, also needs to recognize its own reflection. It's a very different reflection because it's sound, but still there's a self-recognition process going on.
One of the key things I find in the book to let us know about the limitations of humans in trying to assess the intelligence of animals is the story that you tell about gibbons and tools. And it's really interesting about trying to get gibbons to grasp things and what the limitations of their own physique was.
Yeah, so that's a constant refrain, basically, is that when we find negative things, when we don't find something in animals, the first question we should ask is not concluding that they don't have a certain capacity, but ask if we tested them in the right possible way. And with the gibbons are tree living, and they swing by their arms through the trees, and their hands are adapted for that. And so their hands are like hooks. The hands are not really suitable to pick up an item from the floor. Like we can pick up a small item like a peanut, but the gibbon cannot really do that because the hand is basically like a hook. And so they had tested gibbons on a sort of string-pulling task. I'm not going to explain the task, but it was one that had been done on chimpanzees, had been done on monkeys. And the gibbons came out as very poor performers. And so they had concluded that gibbons are not very smart primates, basically. Until a scientist said, well, you know, the gibbon, given the anatomy of its hands, I'm going to test them differently. And he put up the same string-pulling task in a very different way so that they could easily grasp the strings instead of picking them up from the floor. And all of a sudden, the gibbons were just as smart as anyone else. And this is a sort of story that comes back and back in my book also, is that how we test the animals is very much going to be determining what we're going to find. And so for each species, like for the elephant or for the gibbon or for the octopus, you need to find the right task, and you're going to be impressed by what they can do if you find it.
Franz Duval is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? So this concept of using tools, it's much broader, I think, than people assume. It goes well beyond primates, doesn't it?
Yeah, so with tools, the most impressed we are when animals make tools. So using tools is already complex enough. And for example, chimpanzees in the field, they will sometimes carry around three different tools. They go to a particular task, like attacking a beehive to get the honey, and they have three tools with them, one to perforate the thing, one to scoop up the honey, one to beat off the bees, and so on. And so they come with multiple tools to the task, and that's already remarkable enough. But the making of tools, where you fabricate tools, there was a book in the 50s which the title was Man the Toolmaker, because we were the only ones to make tools, it was claimed. Now, of course, chimpanzees, we now know they fabricate tools, they modify twigs and branches to make them suitable for the task. But this has also been discovered now in New Caledonian crows. And so there are certain crows which are very good tool users, and they modify branches in order to make them suitable. And the most famous became Betty the Crow. This was a crow in a lab in Oxford who was giving a straight wire to extract something from a tube, some food. And she kept trying, but she was unsuccessful with the straight metal wire. And then she took it out, and she started bending it and bending it till she had a hook made out of it. And then she could extract the food. So she made Betty the toolmaker. Betty made a tool, and all of a sudden, this whole claim that tool making is uniquely human or is maybe uniquely primate, now we have the crows doing the same thing.
Wow. As we go through the book, I'm impressed by the clarity of the idea that the answers that we get in experiments are very much dependent on the questions we ask.
Yeah, we need to be creative in the questions. And I think in that regard, we have a whole new generation of young scientists who are very eager to demonstrate all sorts of things in animals. And the questions have completely changed. So the question used to be like, how well do animals learn? How good is their memory? Things like that. But now we have much more complex questions like, can they plan ahead? Can they think back in time? Can they control their emotions? Can they understand what other members of their own species know? And so we ask much more complex questions, and we get very interesting answers, I think.
There are some pitfalls here, though, you point out. You give examples of the example of Edward Thorndike's cats. What happened in that experiment?
Well, with the cats, Thorndike thought he had demonstrated that cats will do almost anything and can solve almost any problem if you give them the right rewards. And so he put them in a box, and in the box was a sort of lever that they could press with their flank. And if they pressed it, they would get out, and as soon as they would get out of the box, they would get a little piece of fish. And so he said that the fish was the thing that drove the whole thing, and that it was just basically trial and error learning that was going on, until some other scientists repeated that experiment and demonstrated that the fish played no role at all. If you had no fish at all, they could still do it, dependent on whether there was a friendly human around. If there was a person around that they knew and that they liked, the cats, they would automatically rub their flank against the side of the box, because cats do that. You know, if you come home and your cats will rub against your leg or against the leg of the kitchen table, they will rub against something. And so they demonstrated that the cats were so eager to rub their flanks against things if they saw a person that they liked, that they would get out anyway out of that box. And the fish was immaterial. And so that taught us that this whole idea that everything is based on reward and punishment and simple associative learning is probably wrong, because there's lots of other behavior that's going on in the animals that's relevant.
Franz Duval is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a professor in Emory University's Psychology Department and directs the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. His latest book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? You can help us answer that question on the Jefferson Exchange, perhaps with some stories or questions of your own. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Anne and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. I feel so privileged to be able to ask you a question. One of the indications of intelligence is play. And one of the aspects of play that I find fascinating is interspecies play. I'll give you an example. This happened about 30 years ago. There was a pasture, and we had some cats. And one of the grown cats went out by one of the foals, and it did that head-shaking movement indicating play and ran. The foal also responded with the head-shaking movement and chased the cat. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I don't know that scientists have been very interested in play behavior, but I think it's a fascinating area.
All right, thanks for that, Anne. Let's find out what Franz has to say.
Yeah, I think play is extremely important, and for example, young primates, young chimpanzees, that's what they do the whole day. They sleep and they drink, of course, and then the rest of the time they are roughhousing and running around like little children, and their play actions and their play face, they have a laughing face and make laughing sounds. It's all very similar to what children do, and that's why, for example, you talk about interspecies. It sometimes happens in certain situations, like in ape nurseries, that children can play with the apes, and their play behavior is very similar. I think many animals have certain movements that are recognized as play movements, and like a sort of bouncing gait in land animals, like bouncing around and making sort of quirky movements. and going back and forth, and they recognize that very easily. And so a dog and a cat can play, and recently I saw a video of an otter and a dog playing. So the otter lives in the river and would come out to play with the dog. And I think the animals recognize the play movements because they have a certain rhythm and a certain dynamic to them, and they very easily, between species, they very easily play also.
We have another call here from Jamie in Medford, who's asking about a character who comes up in the book. Jamie, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, guest. Sir, would you please explain to the listening audience the realization that the horse wasn't exactly counting, but its master was giving it certain signals to indicate what was right and what was wrong. And Jeffrey, I'll take the answer off the air.
Thank you, Jamie. Yes, it's a very important part of the book as we talk about Clever Hans.
Yeah, I speak about Clever Hans, and actually, you know, the owner didn't know what he was doing. The owner, this was all unconscious. So Clever Hans was a horse in Germany 100 years ago who you could ask how much is 3 times 4, and he would tap his hoof 12 times. And you could ask him what's the square root of 9, and he would tap 3 times. And these were all unprepared answers. He had not been trained for each answer to make the answer. He would make up answers right in front of you for new questions. So he was truly impressive, and people loved that horse. Until a psychologist started testing him and found that the horse only could give the right answer if the owner knew the answer. And if the owner was put behind the curtain so that the horse could not see the owner, all of a sudden the horse couldn't do it anymore. And so this was very important technique that he had developed to control what the horse was doing. And basically the horse was very good at reading human body language. So the horse was very smart in some way. He would look at the owner, and if he tapped his hoof 12 times, the owner would usually look up at him or shift his position, and the horse would pick up on those cues, even though the owner did that all unconsciously. The owner didn't even know that he was doing this. So the horse was very smart in a way, but not in the way that people thought he was. Now, the important part of that experiment is that since then, we test animals, always taking account of what we call the Clever Hans phenomenon. We need to avoid cues, and so usually when we test them, humans leave the room or at least not visible, because we may be giving unconscious cues to the animals. And we test animals now actually much better than people test children, because children are still being tested sitting on the lap of their parents. Who knows what those parents are doing? All the parents want their kids to be a genius, so they may be influencing what the kid is doing. But with animals, we are very careful when we test them.
Interesting. All the cues that can be read that we never intended to give in the first place by the animal. Let's take another call. We have Bill in Arcata on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Franz Duval, the author of Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Bill, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I want to know where this is going. What does smart mean? Are we testing each animal to find out what it can do in its own circumstances, or are we trying to show that animals are just like people?
Very interesting distinction there. Appreciate that, Bill.
So the main interest is to map the cognitive capacities of lots of animals to see how some of them are very specialized, like the echolocation of the bat or the way an octopus may change color to adjust to its environment. So some of them are very specialized forms of cognition. Other are much more general, like can you think ahead? Can you think back to specific events? And the end goal is to see what is the spectrum of cognitions that we see in animals, and where does human cognition fit in? I look at human cognition as a variation on animal cognition. It is not really fundamentally different, just as our brain is not fundamentally different from the brain of a monkey. It's bigger, but not different. And so to see all these capacities and to sort of map them and how they relate to their natural environment, the goal is, in the end, of course, to place all these cognitions on some sort of evolutionary map and to see how things connect to how animals have evolved. And humans are, in a way, we are special, but in another way, we have to fit into that larger scheme.
I'm glad you brought up octopus, because we talked to Cy Montgomery, the author of The Soul of an Octopus, a few months ago, and she was talking about, she makes a lot of inferences about what the octopus might be thinking or feeling, and I noticed then this gets me into the part of your book where you talk about anthropodenial.
Yeah, I don't know what an octopus thinks or feels, and actually I would say our goal in studying animal cognition is not necessarily knowing what animals think, because I'm not sure we will ever know that, but we present them with problems, and we have ideas of how they may solve them, and then we test, of course, whether these ideas fit. And the connection with humans, what humans think and feel, is to me interesting, because very often when we talk about animal intelligence, people say you should not anthropomorphize the animals, you should not project human feelings and thoughts on the animals. But with animals that are very close to us, actually that's a useful thing to do. Animals that are, let's say, chimpanzees, who are so close to us, we need to use a very similar language for what they do and what we do, because the processes behind their behavior are probably very similar too.
Okay, more primates and more animals of all kind to be talked about yet as we continue our discussion with Franz Duval about his book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take more input from you by phone, by email. We'll return in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Franz Duval. He's well known for his work as a professor at Emory University's Psychology Department, the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. His earlier books include The Bonobo and the Atheist. His latest one is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are?, which is a provocative question about whether we even have the wherewithal to figure out what the other animals' wherewithal might be. Join us on the Exchange if you have some stories to share, some questions to ask. 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You talk about behaviorists and ethologists in the book. Are these alternate paths to understanding animal minds?
Well, they're traditionally two very different schools. The ethologists are biologists in Europe mostly, who were very interested in natural animal behavior, so how do they normally behave? And in wild circumstances or in certain settings, captive settings that are naturalistic. And I was trained as an ethologist, so we look at natural behavior of the animals. And then the behaviorists is more an American school. They their leader was Skinner, and they would put animals in boxes, usually very limited number of species like rats and pigeons, and that's basically all they worked with. They would put them in a little box called a Skinner box and present them as a situation like, let's say there was a lever in the box and the rat can press the lever and get food rewards. And so they test how rats respond to punishment and to rewards in their behavior. So very focused on what is called associative learning or operant conditioning, but much more dictating the behavior of the animal. So instead of waiting for spontaneous behavior, which is really what the ethologists would do, is sort of dictating their behavior and see what they do. And those two schools, which is interesting, they were so different, and they were at odds with each other, but they both agreed that we shouldn't be talking about animal cognition and animal intelligence. Is that it was either all instinctive what the animals did, that's what the biologists would say, or it was all simple learning, and that's what the behaviorists would say. And we have had a big fight, basically in the 1980s and the 1990s, where we broke away from that sort of stranglehold on animal intelligence, and which downplayed animal intelligence tremendously. And now we have a new generation of people who really doesn't care much about those positions anymore, and is much more free in their exploration of animal intelligence.
So nobody's in a camp so much anymore. There's no either or.
Yeah, actually, most of the students we have nowadays, they know both directions, and they have absorbed the best parts of both directions and dropped the bad parts of both of them, the things that were not very productive. And so most students nowadays, they don't even fall into one school or the other. They have absorbed things from both of them.
There are so many amazing stories in here that just demonstrate the limits of our own understanding of what it is that the animals are doing. And you write about the rhesus monkeys and the chimpanzees and an experiment in haptic discrimination. with some interesting results. What happened there?
Yeah, I did that as a student. As a student, I worked with two young chimpanzees, we did a very simple task where they had to stick their hand through a sleeve and then feel something, which is called sort of touch discrimination or haptic discrimination. So they had to discriminate, and then if they found the right shape, they would have get rewarded and so on. And we did the same thing on monkeys. Chimps are, of course, not monkeys. Chimps are apes and have much bigger brains and are generally considered much smarter. But the interesting thing was that the monkeys, they would do that test hundreds of times, and they would be very good at it. And so they were high performers and very eager to perform. And the chimps, they would do it maybe a dozen times, and they would do the right choice, showing that they knew how to do this thing. But then after 12 times, they would lose interest, and they would start to poke at me and make faces at me and try to get me to join them, to play with them. And so they were bored to death by the task, because it's really a bit of a stupid task. It was a task very below their level, so to speak. It wasn't challenging at all. And so it ended up that the monkeys performed much better than the chimps. And that was because the chimps were bored to death by this task. And this indicates already a little bit how when you test animals, you may be thinking you're testing intelligence, but you're testing all sorts of other things. And if animals get bored, they will underperform.
But how do we even know that they can get bored?
Because they didn't want to perform anymore. Even though there was food involved, they didn't think that was important enough to them. And so they thought playing with me, and I was a student, and so I would give in usually at some point. They thought playing with me was better than the food rewards that they got.
Wow, that's amazing. And another question here from Brad in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Franz Duval.
I'm so honored to be able to speak with you, sir. I came to you by way of Christopher Ryan's book, Sex at Dawn, and I'm intrigued with the distinction between chimpanzees and bonobos and their culture, I guess, their social structure. But I guess what I want, and now I've kind of speed read your Apes and the Sushi Master, and I found out I couldn't speed read it because it's too interesting. But anyway, what I'm getting at is I'm thinking that we've been stingy about granting sentience and intelligence to other creatures. And yet, if you have a pet, or if you see how elephants act in grief and all kinds of things, where it's obvious that they do. But even very small creatures, I'm amazed, like a no-see-um. Back in North Carolina, we had these things called no-see-ums. They're like gnats that fly around in the air, and they're so small that if you wave at them, the wind blows them away. But I see them as making decisions. They're trying to steer their way into my eyeball juices and to get away from the hand and everything. So even that little tiny creature with a minuscule brain is somehow making decisions, I think. And that the sentience and intelligence probably runs all the way through the animal kingdom in various levels.
All right. Thanks for that, Brad. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. And people would even add plants to it, I must say. So I'm not sure I'm ready for sentience in plants, but certainly, all animals they need to make decisions. Obviously, they have different kinds of brain power to do it. And insects, of course, have very small brains. But even insects, they need to decide what to eat and what not to eat, and who to follow and who not to follow. And so, decision making is part of everything that animals do. And I'm not sure we can limit, let's say, things like intelligence and cognition to only the species that we're familiar with, like the mammals and the birds. And there's a whole field now coming up of looking at insect intelligence. Certainly insects learn. We know that already, that they can learn things. But there, for example, people who speak of spider cognition. This is based on the jumping spiders. The jumping spiders, they tap the web of another spider to get that animal to come close. And if the other spider comes close, they eat it. And so the other spider is tricked into thinking that there's a prey item in their web, and then they come close, and the jumping spider takes them. And what they have found is that the jumping spiders learn how to do this. It's not something they're born with, so it's not an instinct, so to speak. They learn over time, when they're young, what are the best signals to send on a web to get that other one to get close to you. And so people now speak of spider cognition, and I'm not against that. I think all these processes that we study now in in mammals and birds, some level they're going to be found in other animals.
And you write about the tick in the book, don't you? How the tick will hang there for a long, long time waiting for some mammal to brush up against it?
Which animal? Oh, the tick?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually the scientist von Uexküll who came up with the term Umwelt, who said that each species has its own sort of surrounding world that it lives in, and he called that an Umwelt. He used the tick as an example, saying that the tick has a very simple Umwelt because the tick climbs a grass stem and sits there and can wait for years till a mammal comes by, till he smells a mammal coming by, and then he jumps on it. And that could be us, or it could be a deer, or whatever it could be. And he says that's a very limited Umwelt compared to what we have, but that's how the tick survives, and that's how the tick then sucks up the blood and uses that to feed its eggs and so on.
I didn't realize how long they can hang there just waiting for the meal to come along. Let's take another call. Here's Colin in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Franz Duval.
Yes, I have a question about Coco, the mountain gorilla, who supposedly was taught sign language by, I think, a student or a researcher at Stanford University. Are you familiar with that? And
I know Coco. Yeah, yeah.
Any comments about her?
All right. Thank you for that, Colin.
Yeah, in my book, I'm a bit skeptical about language studies on apes because even though they have gone further than we had expected when they started in the 50s and the 60s, the apes were capable of learning symbols and to indicate a bit like words, you know, symbols for all sorts of objects and all sorts of activities. And so that was great. But at some point, the research sort of stopped in the sense that the apes were not using these symbols to really communicate in terms of language. They were not asking important questions to us, and they were basically requesting like food or activities. And so that's why that research on ape language has sort of petered out. And Coco, and the Coco Foundation, I think, sometimes exaggerates what Coco does. So recently they had a video where Coco was warning us against climate change. And I really, for the life of me, I cannot imagine that Coco has an understanding of climate change. And so I felt that was a sort of exaggeration. And there are serious studies on symbol-using animals, like, let's say, Alex the parrot or Kamsi the bonobo. But the Coco studies are not very well controlled, and we don't know exactly what's going on there. And I think they sometimes exaggerate what Coco is communicating.
Okay, good to know where you stand on that. I was going to ask you about some of the stories in the book about other primates working together. I think it was chimps where the younger chimps were getting into a fight, and the two mothers were kind of afraid what to do there.
Yeah, so I find that very interesting to see that kind of social solutions. So, for example, in chimpanzees, a female may broker a peace between two males who have been fighting and bring them together. And the case that you describe are two juveniles who were fighting, and the two mothers, they didn't know what to do. Because if one mother steps in, then the other one will. I hear that at daycare centers with humans, this happens also. Is that if one mother steps in to stop the fight, the other mother will also often step in, and then we have a fight between two females instead of between the two juveniles. And so the two mothers were getting very nervous by this fight, and one of them solved the issue by waking up the alpha female who was asleep nearby, an older female. So she went over to her and poked her in the side and woke her up, and the alpha female only needed to look 1 second at the situation and understood what was going on and broke up the kids' fight very easily.
With a grunt, was it?
She was a sort of neutral force, a police force, so to speak, in this case.
It just fascinated to me that it's like, well, neither one of us can do this, but let's get her to do this because she'll know what to do, and off they went.
Yeah.
Other stuff, though, about animals and their ability to recognize each other. And we come back to crows here with John Martzloff at the University of Washington, and he did something interesting with face masks. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so what they did with the crows is that they captured them, and the crows, of course, don't like that. They captured and released them, but the crows hate that process. And they would put a certain mask on the person who did that, And then with the mask, of course, the mask can travel from person to person. They would walk around with that mask on the campus of the university where the crows lived, and they would have other masks that were neutral, that were never used in the capture procedure, to walk around. And what they found is that the crows recognized the person, the mask, and would start yelling and hurling abuse at the person who was walking around with it. And they would even transmit the knowledge to other crows. And so other crows who had never been captured in their life, they also thought this was a horrible person that they needed to yell at.
So they spread the word somehow. How do we know?
Yeah.
How would they get the information transmitted to the other crows?
Well, if you're a crow and you hear other crows yelling at a sort of predator, basically, you hear the others yell at the predator. You think, well, I'm going to yell too, and that's how you pick up the information.
Do the animals, Franz, that you study still continue to surprise you?
Oh, yeah, we still find surprising things, and at the moment I'm working a lot on empathy. How do they relate to the feelings of each other? And we do also studies on fairness to see how do they respond to being treated unfairly. And so we do, for example, experiments where one animal may get a very good quality reward for a very simple task, and the next animal will get a poor quality reward. And they're very responsive to that, is that they compare what they get to what somebody else is getting.
Oh, I've read about those, yeah. They have a sense of justice, almost.
Yeah.
All right, it's amazing stuff. Franz de Waal is the author of Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Thank you for joining us for a lively discussion today.
You're welcome.
All right, take care.